Who amongst us hasn't dreamed of shaking off the rat race and reinventing a cooler, more tanned version of themselves in some little beachside village? Well, journalist Kate Halfpenny and her husband, Chris Ogue, actually pulled it off. During the pandemic lockdowns, they fled Melbourne in favour of the seaside town of Ocean Grove. But that move, which was meant to bring calm, stirred up something else. Chris's drinking, already a quiet presence in their life, began to take over. And suddenly what was supposed to be a new beginning became a breaking point. Kate writes about this time in her memoir, Boogie Wonderland. Kate Halfpenny and Chris Ogue are both with me this morning. Kate, Chris, welcome.
Good morning, Tegan. Thanks so much for having us.
Good morning, Tegan.
Kate, you said when you first moved during the pandemic, you felt like you were on holiday for the first couple of months, which sounds lovely. When did that start to change?
Yeah, it started to change, Tegan, probably about 3 months in. Before then, we were treating our new house like it was some kind of luxury resort, you know, cocktails in the blow-up Clark Robber pool at 3 in the afternoon and boogie boarding every day. It seemed incredible. But after about 3 to 6 months, when reality hits and you know that you have to keep working and you have to mow the lawn instead of just lounging around on it, things started to change. And then we had a terrible upheaval in our life when Chris's brother died, and that brought everything else into sort of stark relief, and the holiday was over.
Yeah, that's really awful. That's sort of putting a lot of pressure on. Chris, I'm hearing like cocktails in the pool sounds lovely. Like that is how we spend so much of our holiday time, is alcohol's part of those celebrations. When did that start to shift for you?
I'd say it started the shift, you know, when that first summer came to an end. Winter sets in. We didn't have family or friends down there, and it was just the sense of isolation, boredom. I was probably drinking too much to start with before we moved down, but it just seemed to, you know, gradually creep up. And yeah, then when John died, I just completely spiraled out of control.
Yeah. Do you mind sort of talking to me about what your relationship with booze had been before then? Because as I think we'll get to soon, like Australians have a pretty high tolerance for alcohol, I think, just as at baseline.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I grew up in a house that was just awash with booze. It was a bit of a party house. You know, so when I look at how long I'd been, you know, in effect binge drinking, it's close to 40 years. And my relationship with alcohol was, I thought I was in control. You know, generally speaking, I wouldn't drink Monday to Thursday, but come the weekend, all bets were off. And I'd drink myself stupid. And that was the pattern for literally decades. So it's interesting. Prior to moving down to Ocean Grove, I wouldn't have actually been honest at all in saying that I had a problem with it. But, you know, deep down, like looking back, I did.
Kate, what was your perception at that time? Because alcohol was just kind of a pretty prominent feature of your relationship and how you guys had fun together.
Yeah, Kate, that's right. I mean, I was an absolute willing wingman with Chris's drinking. You know, we both loved it. We loved going to overseas resorts and having happy hour, and we loved splashing each other a wine while we were cooking dinner at night. You know, it made us kind of glittery and fun. And I loved it. I loved drinking with Chris until, you know, I became slowly aware that what had been this sort of welcome third wheel in our relationship had turned into something much grimmer and darker that I was just constantly worried about. It didn't feel fun anymore. You know, it felt like the party was over and that we both needed to do some packing up pretty quickly.
So there's a pretty scary moment in the book that was sort of the catalyst, I suppose, for this conversation to start. Kate, do you mind telling me the story?
Yeah, Tegan, we were at the beach one afternoon with my dad, who was then 84 and had two dodgy knees, and I was, he got knocked over in the shallows down at the main surf beach. He's a pretty strong swimmer, so I thought there was no problem, but I'd forgotten that his 84-year-old knees wouldn't let him stand up in the shallows. And I was about 30 metres away watching him, you know, with waves just crashing over his face, and his sort of head was upturned to the sky. But, you know, the water was just smashing him. And I'd been boogie boarding, sort of tossed the boogie board off and started to run, but thought oh, it's fine. You know, my husband is, he's right there. He can save Dad. But Chris couldn't lift my dad up off the sand. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? It looked like they were doing this sort of clumsy dance together. And I sort of arrived on the scene and pushed Chris off and hauled Dad to his feet, you know, saying, Dad, you've got to help me stand up. Just stand up. And it was like he was suction cupped to the ground. But anyway, I got him up and I was thinking to myself, you know, my husband was, why is he grinning at me as if he's drunk? And then I realised it was because he actually was drunk. So, you know, he'd driven us to the beach drunk, he was in the water drunk, and that was sort of the start for me of thinking, what's going on here? And it was really weird because, I mean, I'm a trained observer of people. That's been my job for a long time. So, you know, it would have made sense if I'd noticed that the one other person who lived with me in a pretty small house was drinking seriously every day, but I didn't notice it. And that's, you know, took Dad home, and that's when we had our first reckoning about it. And I said, you know, this has to change, what's been going on. And that's the point when Chris told me the truth about how his drinking had evolved in the last months.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor and I'm talking to Kate Halfpenny and Chris Ogue, husband and wife, about basically pandemic lockdowns and a sea change that really brought a problem relationship with alcohol to a head. Heather on the Gold Coast has texted in saying, I just realised that alcohol was the indirect cause of all three of my marriages ending, not from excess drinking, but from me quitting drinking. Turns out that not drinking brings out my true introverted character. I've not drunk for years now and I'm happily single in my 60s. That feels like a good ending for Heather's story. Chris, I'm really conscious that we're sort of talking about the probably some of the most embarrassing parts of your life really openly. Kate's written a book about it. We're talking about it on the radio. How does it feel to have your dirty laundry aired in public like this?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think, you know, it's our story. It's a huge part of our story together. I'm quite used to being featured in Kate's written work, in her article, so it's not as though I'm completely unfamiliar with the feeling. But it's you know, it's not a moral failing. It's an illness. I was horribly ashamed of my behaviour, but I don't have that sense of shame anymore. If talking about it is going to help someone feel, you know, less alone or less filled with self-loathing, then to me it's worth it.
Yeah, talking about it as an illness really brings us to the treatment and how hard it was for you guys to find the treatment that Chris needed. You were surprised by this, Kate.
Yeah, it's funny, Tegan. I mean, it's nothing that I'd ever thought about. Oh, I must find a rehab centre for my husband or for anyone else in life that I love. And we were actually lucky that we had health insurance with fantastic extras, because if you don't, you know, I think that the cost at that stage for a 3-week residential stay was about $21,000, and I think that that's pretty standard. So, you know, that was the option that we took, the private health route. Even then, we had to wait a couple of months to get into the centre, which was recommended to us, which had sort of both detox facilities and a therapeutic approach, which was what we went for the first time around when Chris opted for rehab. But my, you know, in researching it, I just was astonished to find out the massive problems that exist when people who don't have private health insurance or the, you know, the financial resources that we were lucky enough to have, you know, it's so hard for people to get into a residential bed. And I just found dozens of stories online, you know, about the crisis in the rehab space, where people are waiting for up to a year to get a bed to help them to get out of this terrible spiral.
And then I've just, you know, you've mentioned it in passing there, Chris, it took more than one go to get this, to get the help that you needed.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did. I think the first time around, it was about 6 months after John had died, I had to go to a rehab centre in Sydney, and it was very much a model of deprivation. You were completely cut off from everything. You weren't allowed to exercise. You weren't allowed to watch TV. And it was a trauma-based model. And you know, I think it's terrific if it works for you, but for me, it didn't work, and probably because I wanted to keep drinking at that point. I wasn't ready.
And Kate, you're looking at Chris, this person that you love, you know, really wanting the best for them and also your own life. What's going through your head at this moment?
Oh, so much, Tegan. Like, anger, I have to say. I was furious with him for a long time. I was devastated. I was sad. I was frustrated. You know, like it's this whole gamut of emotions, because basically I was watching our beautiful marriage implode and, you know, watching the man that I loved so much become someone else. Like, I don't know if you've seen that movie. It's one of the Lord of the Rings ones, when the king is sort of covered with dust and worms and stuff, and he's freed from that and you know, he cracks open that carapace. But, you know, for a long time I felt like Chris was that guy. He was sitting there in this sort of dusty, mouldy shell that he couldn't break out of. But, you know, I have to say, it's really important for people to know that, you know, Chris was never violent when he was drinking. He never whizzed through our money. He was never aggressive. He was always really great fun to drink with. And I think that that's why a lot of people get confused about thinking, we didn't know Chris had a problem with alcohol, because to the outside world, he actually didn't. And I think this is the message that I would love to get across to a lot of people, that, you know, we have this stereotypical view that an alcoholic is this old smelly dude drinking from a paper bag on a park bench. But, you know, in reality, it's the middle-aged man with a mortgage and a decent job. He's the one queuing behind you in the MCG members bar, you know, the one who seems fine because he's functioning until he's not. You know, as Chris said, we think about alcoholic as if it's some sort of, you know, moral failing, instead of it's really just an illness. But, you know, for me, the issue was that I was seeing firsthand how much silence breeds stigma and how much hiding it makes the problem grow in the dark. And I found it really hard to ring up my best friends and say, Chris is going to rehab, he's an alcoholic, because back then, it's only, what, I don't know, a couple of years ago, not long, but at that point I was one of the people who was seeing alcoholism as having a stigma. I hadn't come around yet to that space of thinking it's like cancer or it's like diabetes, it's an illness, and we need to get help for it. It was a really hard time to even admit to myself, let alone anyone else, I'm married to an alcoholic. But, you know, my mantra for Chris was, I'm happy to be married to an alcoholic. I just don't want to be married to a drunk. And that's when we both, you know, realised that he needed to get the help.
Chris, did you feel like the Dusty King? Like, did you see in yourself what Kate was seeing, or were you not there at that point?
I saw it, but I didn't want to acknowledge it. You know, the effect that it was having on Kate, the effect that it was having on my health. I mean, you know, a lot of alcoholics say it, but I was highly functioning. I had a great job. That was probably the only thing that I could focus on, that I could do well. Everything else was just falling to bits, and I knew it was happening. I couldn't face it.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National with me, Tegan Taylor, Kate Halfpenny and Chris Ogar, speaking with such frankness about Chris's struggles with alcoholism that really sort of came to a head during the pandemic. And so many beautiful texts on the text line. Rosie says, Chris and Kate, thank you for your bravery in sharing this story with such frankness. I have no doubt it will help people in similar circumstances. And what a beautiful love story. You're to be commended. So I think we'd better talk about, like, the reason we're having this conversation today with such frankness and self-awareness on your part is because you have managed to navigate through this realization and then this difficulty in finding treatment to get the treatment. Tell me, Chris, about getting to the point where you were ready and getting the treatment that you needed.
So, Tegan, that was roughly 2 years after the first attempt at rehab. So it was only, I think, February last year. I was worried that I was going to die. I couldn't actually live with myself putting Kate through any more of what I'd put her through. Everything was going to fall apart, and I was ready. I knew it had to stop. I didn't want to die.
So you went to rehab. It stuck, I suppose, this time. Was it about the treatment itself, or was it about your mindset, or was it both?
It was both. It was both. It was again a rehab clinic in Sydney, and it was another 3 week stay. But after you'd done your initial detox on truckloads of Valium, you were allowed to go out for a couple of hours a day if you behaved yourself. You could go out for 6 hours on the weekend. You could work. You could make calls. It was great to still be connected. It was much more of a science-based model than a trauma-based model of rehab. It was that, and that hitting nearly 54 at that point, I had two birthdays in rehab, I knew it had to stop, and I wanted it to stop.
Kate, you've written about it in your book. You think that we need to rethink our relationship with alcohol as a nation. What kind of conversations would you like to have, would like people to be having with each other and with themselves?
Oh, that's such a great question, Tegan. I mean, I think that I want people to know that being an alcoholic does not reduce people, especially with my beautiful Chris. You know, I think that what he has been through, his alcoholism gives him insight. He's hardly a crusader, but he wants people to understand that addiction doesn't discriminate and that recovery starts with honesty, not hiding. So, you know, telling this story isn't about airing dirty laundry. It's about replacing shame with understanding and replacing silence or ignoring the issue with connection and acceptance and help. And, you know, this is such a universal story that we have. You know, everyone listening today will have people in their life, and maybe it's actually, you know, them that they suspect are struggling with alcohol. And, you know, they're scared of feeling judged or about that stigma to actually admit it. I mean, I get it. If we look just at the pandemic narrative, it's astonishing that I think it was between January 2019 to the end of 2021, alcohol sales in Australia jumped by 29%. You know, everyone was medicating with booze, and that pandemic pick-me-up was approved of by the government. I still find it so bizarre to think that we couldn't go and walk on the beach with our family, but we could go off to a bottle shop and get on it every night. That sort of really normalised the role that alcohol plays in our lives. And I personally find it, I wish that the conversation was more honest. I wish that more people would look at it as an illness rather than as a dirty little secret. And I wish that there was more government money and government money given, government attention given to this issue, given the great potential that alcohol has to cause harm in people's lives. I think there's something crazy like 14 million interactions at hospitals every year due to issues with alcohol, whether it's heart disease or stroke or diabetes or whether it's domestic violence. You know, like it's actually astonishing if you can compare that to something like motor neurone disease, which is such a cruel, hideous disease, and I'm so loving every dollar that is raised for that disease, which is millions and millions a year. But at any time, there's less than 3,000 Australians per year who have motor neurone disease, compared to the hundreds of thousands, probably millions of us, who have trouble with alcoholism. And, you know, for me, that's just astonishing, and I wish that there was more of a spotlight turned on it, but a non-judgmental spotlight.
Chris, what do you hope people take away from your story?
I guess just a sense of hope. And you know, when I say that if I can do it, anyone can, like, I actually mean that. you know, it's... I'm so lucky to have Kate, who's just loved me so hard. I think the important thing is that, unlike people with other illnesses, you know, who are desperate and crying for help and will tell you straight away, alcoholics won't do that. So it comes down to those that love them and their friends to help them, to jump in and help them.
Chris, Kate, thank you both so much for sharing so openly today, Kate Halfpenny and Chris Oag. And thank you for your stories as well. Another Chris says, I went through a similar thing with my wife. The stigma must stop. It's the biggest problem. Another person says, my experience is that came down to a choice between my alcoholism or my marriage. At that time, I didn't have enough self-esteem to stop on my own. I have my husband to thank for leading me to discover the real reason why I was self-medicating with alcohol. If this story has raised issues for you or you want to seek more help, you can call the National Alcohol and Other Drug Hotline. The number is 1-800-250-015.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.